Have you ever kept a box or bag or trunk of stuff that your children or grandchildren or nephews and nieces gave you or made for you? So here are a few things that my children made for me in the 1980s. Here's a heart. Here's writing in the back too. I'm not going to tell you what it says. No, it just says to Daddy, I love you. And here's a Christmas card. Red was very popular in the family. And here's a rainbow picture. With stamps, flowers. So I put them in what I call a memory box. That's not very original, but I periodically look at the memory box and the things my children made for me and wonder about innocence, about life and death, about the beauty of my children and all children, about the relationship I have with my children, about the sanctity of life. And I know there's a special binding between me and my children, a covenant of love that is, for me anyway, unconditional. There is really nothing that they could say or do that would prevent me from loving them. And this is actually my secret goal for myself, is to love all people unconditionally. So one, it's not a secret anymore. And secondly, it's only something a saint could accomplish, and we all know how well I fail at that. Yes, Sue is laughing. Nevertheless, I am aware of my capacity to love unconditionally, at the very least for my children, and it's an immeasurable gift that my children have given me. And so I keep some memories of their lives as a reminder of a special binding among us. It is not unlike a story that I've mentioned before, which I'm going to repeat, about a gift that Robert Fulghum's daughter, Molly, once gave him. A lunch-sized paper bag full of her stuff, consisting of two hair ribbons, two small stones, a plastic dinosaur, a pencil stub, a tiny seashell, two animal crackers, a marble, a used lipstick, a small doll, two chocolate kisses, and 13 pennies. Along with his lunch bag, Fulghum threw out Molly's junk bag at his office. Later at home, she came to her dad. "Hey, where's my bag? Those are the things in the sack, Daddy, the ones I really like. I thought you might like to play with them, but now I want them back." And she handed him the note that she forgot to put in the bag that said, "I love you, Daddy." "I looked long at the face of my child," writes Fulghum. "Molly had given me her treasures, all that a seven-year-old held dear, love in a paper bag. And I had missed it. It wasn't the first or the last time I felt my daddy permit was about to run out." Fulghum returned to his office and, with the help of the custodian, found the bag and all its contents. After dinner that evening, he asked Molly to tell him about the stuff in the sack, and she took each piece out and placed them neatly in a row. "It took a long time to tell," he says. "Everything had a story, a memory, or was attached to dreams and imaginary friends. Fairies had actually brought some of the things. And I had given her the chocolate kisses, and she had kept them for when she needed them." In time, Molly turned her attention to other things, found other treasures, grew up, something. And me, I was left holding the bag. She gave it to me one morning and never asked for its return. And so I have it still. "Sometimes I think of all the times," he says, "in this sweet life when I must have missed the affection I was being given. A friend calls this standing knee-deep in the river and dying of thirst." So the worn paper sack is there in the box, left over from a time when a child said, "Here, this is the best I've got. Take it, it's yours. Such as I have, give I to thee." I missed it the first time, but it's my bag now. There is a special binding that occurs throughout life in all sorts of relationships. And we yearn. We yearn to have those relationships of love, those bindings, to be unconditional. But none of us is a saint. And that's okay. I much rather be human only. Theologically, this binding, this relational experience, is known as covenant. My relationship with my children and Fulgham's with his are covenantal. The life force within my children moved them to become aware of the beautiful, authentic, holy children that they are. And as a father, I covenant to provide them as much as possible with a safe context and nurturing that allows for that growth and flourishing to take place. Our faith community as Unitarian Universalist is similar. Our church consists of people who are part of a special binding, a covenant that promises to nurture the Spirit. Our members do not subscribe to specific beliefs, doctrines, or creeds. Our members, we are not a traditional or orthodox church founded on dogma. Rather, we choose to work with creation to help create the holy through relationship. This is what it means to be a member of this congregation. We all gather together often on Sunday mornings to acknowledge the special binding. And within this context, we sometimes make specific covenants, usually through ritual. A child dedication is an example, as is an ordination. The ordination ceremony this afternoon for Don Fortune establishes a special binding, a covenant made between this congregation and Don. It is this congregation that is ordaining Don, not the Unitarian Universalist Association, not the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, but us. This is no small matter. No covenant is insignificant, for all covenants are relational and consequently sacred. This afternoon's ceremony is a holy act, and as such, it is a celebration which is full of joy and blessing. I want to read to you part of what I wrote for the charge to the congregation at Sarah Heyman's installation in Ellsworth this past September. A couple of you have already heard this. But I do this because I want us to be aware of the kinds of things a covenant entails when we ordain a minister, call a settled minister, or install a minister. I want us to acknowledge that the relationship between minister and congregation is a complex one, one that often can be clarified through covenant. So I'm quoting my own words here, using the pronouns with which Sarah identifies. Let me first say that the context for the 4 points I wish to make is this. To be a minister of a Unitarian Universalist congregation is an incredibly lonely job. We all want a piece of the minister. We have all sorts of expectations of her. We all want our intellectual, emotional, and spiritual needs met. So what sustains the minister? How does she maintain her non-anxious presence in the midst of a community where there are as many opinions and beliefs as there are members and friends? What is it that feeds her spiritual needs? How does she continue to love you when she's burnt out and emotionally spent? This, my friends, is a lonely profession. So first, be kind to your minister. Covenant with her that you as a people and as individuals will strive always to be kind. And when you fail, because we're all human, forgive each other. Second, but related to kindness, is to help create equitable boundaries. When I was ordained, a colleague charged me with the words, "Be clear about your boundaries because your congregation won't." I'm not convinced of that. I think a minister in the congregation that has called her can create fair and clear boundaries that mutually support one another. Both our UU Association and our Ministers Association have established some boundaries, such as making sure a minister has 2 months off each year. Note. Has one Sunday a month off. Note. Has a sabbatical after 5 years of service. Note. And so on. But there are many, many more substantive boundaries that need to be named and spoken through a covenant between the people and the minister. Boundaries are a way to be kind to one another. Third, it is important to live with this essential paradox. Your minister needs enough authority to be able to utilize fully her skills, abilities, knowledge, insights, and creativity. At the same time, however, ministry must be shared. The ministry of this faith community is a shared ministry. This, too, is part of the covenant established between minister and congregation. Nevertheless, to call a minister and give her little or no authority to effect healthy change within the community is not a calling at all. And fourth, it behooves the congregation to listen carefully and thoughtfully to its minister's vision of ministry for the congregation and for the community beyond. Vision is vital to the well-being of a faith community, and the minister is the keeper of the vision. A church is not a business, nor are committees meant to do business only. The work of both church and committees is service, that is, of ministry itself. And it is the minister who must always keep this in mind, who looks beyond the daily routine of church business to see what's possible. Trust and respect the work of vision that your minister brings to you. So be kind. Make clear and equitable boundaries. Share ministry while allowing for ministerial authority and support and foster visioning. By doing so, you continue to be brave, you continue to be bold and courageous, and you continue to love each other. So whether it's an ordination, the call for a settled minister, or an installation, the congregation is creating a special binding, a covenant that incorporates these points. We often call it a good fit between minister and congregation. To thrive and flourish together, however, the minister must also enter the relationship with the congregation with at least one basic motive and commitment: to grow into love with the congregation. So when we ordain Dawn this afternoon, we are telling ourselves in Dawn that, in representing all UU churches, we commit ourselves once again to compassion and kindness, to fairness and equitable boundaries, to healthy and appropriate ministerial authority, and to visioning. And we do particularly well in our relationship with ministers when we feel the love from them. We are telling the world that we are in covenant, that there is a special binding. When I was in New York City with my children last weekend, they gave me a gift. They framed it. They framed the Vermont license plate that I had since 1985, when my son was born. The first vehicle upon which I put this plate was a VW Vanagon camper, which I kept for 15 years. The last vehicle that this plate was on was my bright red Toyota Solara, which some of you may have seen when I first came here. In 2012, I gave my son the Solara so he had this Vermont license plate on for several months while he was establishing himself in Los Angeles. When I gave him the car, it had about 225,000 miles on it. And it is still going strong to this day. But he figures that this license plate has traveled for a million miles. I didn't tell him how guilty that made me feel regarding my carbon footprint. But I have to admit that this, to me, is an awesome gift. It's all beaten up. It's rusty around the bolt holes. But it holds 27 years of memories for me, many of which are about my children and many about the beginning of my relationship with Sue. But this gift won't go into any memory box. I will put it where I can see it every day. For it is to me a gift that is symbolic of a special binding. Blessed be.